the office. Upon hearing this news, Salander was silent for a long time on the other end of the telephone before she finally agreed. She had planned to meet him at his office, exactly like last time. Now she was forced to see him in unfamiliar territory. The meeting was set for Friday evening. She had been given the building code, and she rang his doorbell at 8:30, half an hour later than agreed. That was how much time she had needed in the darkness of the building's stairwell to run through her plan one last time, consider alternatives, steel herself, and mobilize the courage she would need. At 8, Blomqvist switched off his computer and put on his outdoor clothing. He left the lights on in his office. Outside, the sky was bright with stars, and the night was freezing. He walked briskly up the hill past Wanger's house, taking the road to Ostergården. Beyond Wanger's house, he turned off to the left, following an uglier path along the shore. The lighted buoys flickered out on the water, and the lights from Hedestad gleamed prettily in the dark. He needed fresh air, but above all he wanted to avoid the spying eyes of Isabella Wanger. Not far from Martin Wanger's house, he rejoined the road and arrived at Cecilia Wanger's door just after 8:30. They went straight to her bedroom. They met once or twice a week. Cecilia had not only become his lover out here in his place of exile, she had also become the person he had begun to confide in. It was significantly more rewarding discussing Harriet Wanger with her than with her uncle. The plan began to go wrong, almost from the start. Bjurman was wearing a bathrobe when he opened the door to his apartment. He was cross at her arriving late and motioned her brusquely inside. She was wearing black jeans, a black T-shirt, and the obligatory leather jacket. She wore black boots and a small rucksack with a strap across her chest. "Haven't you even learned to tell the time?" Bjurman said. Salander did not reply. She looked around. The apartment looked much as she had expected after studying the building plans in the archives of the city zoning office. The light-coloured furniture was birch and beechwood. "Come on," Bjurman said in a friendlier tone. He put his arm around her shoulders and led her down a hall into the apartment's interior. No small talk. He opened the door to the bedroom. There was no doubt as to what services Salander was expected to perform. She took a quick look around. Bachelor furnishings. A double bed with a high bedstead of stainless steel. A low chest of drawers that also functioned as a bedside table. Bedside lamps with muted lighting. A wardrobe with a mirror along one side. A cane chair and a small desk in the corner next to the door. He took her by the hand and led her to the bed. "Tell me what you need money for this time. More computer accessories?"
"Food," she said.
"Of course. How stupid of me. You missed our last meeting." He placed his hand under her chin and lifted her face, so their eyes met. "How are you?" She shrugged. "Have you thought about what I said last time?"
"About what?"
"Lisbeth, don't act any more stupid than you are. I want us to be good friends and to help each other out." She said nothing. Advocate Bjurman resisted an impulse to give her a slap, to put some life into her. "Did you like our grown-up game from last time?"
"No."
He raised his eyebrows. "Lisbeth, don't be foolish."
"I need money to buy food."
"But that's what we talked about last time. If you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. But if you're just going to cause trouble..." His grip on her chin tightened and she twisted away.
"I want my money. What do you want me to do?"
"You know what I want." He grabbed her shoulder and pulled her towards the bed.
"Wait,"
Salander said hastily. She gave him a resigned look and then nodded curtly. She took off her rucksack and leather jacket with the rivets and looked around. She put her jacket on the chair, set her rucksack on the round table, and took several hesitant steps to the bed. Then she stopped, as if she had cold feet. Bjurman came closer.
"Wait,"
she said once more, in a tone as if to say that she was trying to talk sense into him.
"I don't want to have to suck your dick every time I need money."
The expression on Bjurman's face suddenly changed. He slapped her hard. Salander opened her eyes wide, but before she could react, he grabbed her by the shoulder and threw her onto the bed. The violence caught her by surprise. When she tried to turn over, he pressed her down on the bed and straddled her. Like the time before, she was no match for him in terms of physical strength. Her only chance of fighting back was if she could hurt him by scratching his eyes or using some sort of weapon. But her planned scenario had already gone to hell. Shit, she thought, when he ripped off her T-shirt. She realized with terrifying clarity that she was out of her depth. She heard him open the dresser door next to the bed and caught the clanking sound of metal. At first she did not understand what was happening, then she saw the handcuffs close around her wrist. He pulled up her arm, placed the handcuffs around one of the bedposts, and locked her other hand. It did not take him long to pull off her boots and jeans, then he took off her knickers and held them in his hand. "You have to learn to trust me, Lisbeth," he said. "I'm going to teach you how this grown-up game is played. If you don't treat me well, you have to be punished. When you're nice to me, we'll be friends." He sat astride her again. "So you don't like anal sex," he said. Salander opened her mouth to scream. He grabbed her hair and stuffed the knickers in her mouth. She felt him putting something around her ankles, spread her legs apart and tie them so that she was lying there completely vulnerable. She heard him moving around the room, but she could not see through the T-shirt around her face. It took him several minutes. She could hardly breathe. Then she felt an excruciating pain as he forced something up her anus. Cecilia Wanger still had a rule that Blomqvist was not to stay all night. Sometime after 2 in the morning he began to dress while she lay naked on the bed, smiling at him.
"I like you, Michael. I like your company."
"I like you, too." She pulled him back to the bed and took off the shirt he had just put on. He stayed for 1 more hour. When later he passed by Wanger's house, he was sure he saw one of the curtains shift upstairs. Salander was allowed to put on her clothes. It was 4 on Saturday morning. She picked up her leather jacket and rucksack and hobbled to the front door, where he was waiting for her, showered and neatly dressed. He gave her a check for 2,500 kronor. "I'll drive you home," he said, and opened the door. She crossed the threshold out of the apartment and turned to face him. Her body looked fragile and her face was swollen from crying, and he almost recoiled when he met her eyes. Never in his life had he seen such naked, smouldering hatred. Salander looked just as deranged as her casebook indicated.
"No," she said, so quietly that he barely heard the word. "I can get home on my own."
He put a hand on her shoulder.
"Are you sure?"
She nodded. His grip on her shoulder tightened.
"Remember what we agreed. You'll come back here next Saturday."
She nodded again, cowed. He let her go. Chapter 14. Saturday, March 8th to Monday, March 17th. Salander spent the week in bed, with pain in her abdomen, bleeding from her rectum, and less visible wounds that would take longer to heal. What she had gone through was very different from the first rape in his office. It was no longer a matter of coercion and degradation. This was systematic brutality. She realized much too late that she had utterly misjudged Bjurman. She had assumed he was on a power trip and liked to dominate, not that he was an all-out sadist. He had kept her in handcuffs half the night. Several times she believed he meant to kill her, and at one point he had pressed a pillow over her face until she thought she was going to pass out. She did not cry. Apart from the tears of pure physical pain, she shed not a single tear. And when she left the apartment, she made her way with difficulty to the taxi stand at Odenplan. With difficulty, she climbed the stairs to her own apartment. She showered and wiped the blood from her genitals. Then she drank a pint of water with 2 Rohypnol and stumbled to her bed and pulled the duvet over her head. She woke up at midday on Sunday, empty of thoughts and with constant pain in her head, muscles and abdomen. She got up, drank 2 glasses of kefir, and ate an apple. Then she took 2 more sleeping pills and went back to bed. She did not feel like getting up until Tuesday. She went out and bought a big box of Billy's Pan Pizza, stuck 2 of them in the microwave and filled a thermos with coffee. She spent that night on the internet reading articles and theses on the psychopathology of sadism. She found 1 article published by a women's group in the United States in which the author claimed that the sadist chose his relationships with almost intuitive precision. The sadist's best victim was the one who voluntarily went to him because she did not think she had any choice. The sadist specialized in people who were in a position of dependence. Advocate Vuurman had chosen her as a victim. That told her something about the way she was viewed by other people. On Friday, a week after the second rape, she walked from her apartment to a tattoo parlor in the Hornstool district. She had made an appointment, and there were no other customers in the shop. The owner nodded, recognizing her. She chose a simple little tattoo depicting a narrow band and asked to have it put on her ankle. She pointed.
"The skin is very thin there. It's going to hurt a lot," said the tattoo artist.
"That's okay,"
Salander said, taking off her jeans and putting her leg up.
"Okay, a band. You already have loads of tattoos. Are you sure you want another one?"
"It's a reminder."
Blomqvist left the café when Suzanne closed at 2 on Saturday afternoon. He had spent the morning typing up his notes in his iBook. He walked to Consum and bought some food and cigarettes before he went home. He had discovered fried sausage with potatoes and beets, a dish he had never been fond of, but for some reason it seemed perfectly suited to a cabin in the country. At around 7 in the evening, he stood by the kitchen window thinking. Cecilia Wanger had not called. He had run into her that afternoon when she was buying bread at the café, but she had been lost in her own thoughts. It did not seem likely that she would call this evening. He glanced at the little TV that he almost never used. Instead, he sat at the kitchen bench and opened A Mystery by Sue Grafton. Salander returned at the agreed-upon time to Bjurman's apartment near Odenplan. He let her in with a polite, welcoming smile.
"And how are you doing today, dear Lisbeth?"
She did not reply. He put an arm around her shoulder.
"I suppose it was a bit rough last time," he said. "You looked a little subdued."
She gave him a crooked smile, and he felt a sudden pang of uncertainty.
"This girl is not all there. I have to remember that."
He wondered if she would come around.
"Shall we go into the bedroom?" Salander said.
"On the other hand, she may be with it. Today I'll take it easy on her. Build up her trust."
He had already put out the handcuffs on the chest of drawers. It was not until they reached the bed that Bjurman realized that something was amiss. She was the one leading him to the bed, not the other way around. He stopped and gave her a puzzled look when she pulled something out of her jacket pocket, which he thought was a mobile telephone. Then he saw her eyes.
"Say good night,"
she said. She shoved the taser into his left armpit and fired off 75,000 volts. When his legs began to give way, she put her shoulder against him and used all her strength to push him down onto the bed. Cecilia Wanger felt a little tipsy. She had decided not to telephone Blomqvist. Their relationship had developed into a ridiculous bedroom farce in which Blomqvist had to tiptoe around trying to get to her house unnoticed. She in turn played a lovesick teenage girl who could not control herself. Her behaviour the past few weeks had been reckless. "The problem is that I like him too much," she thought. "He's going to end up hurting me." She sat for a long time, wishing that Mikhail Blomqvist had never come to Hedeby. She had opened a bottle of wine and drunk 2 glasses in her loneliness. She turned on the TV to watch Rapport and try to follow the world situation, but very soon tired of the reasoned commentary on why President Bush had to bomb Iraq to smithereens. Instead, she sat on the living room sofa and picked up Gellert Thomas's book, The Laser Man. She read only a few pages before she had to put the book down. That made her instantly think of her father. What kind of fantasies did he have? The last time they really saw each other was in 1984, when she went with him and Birger hare hunting north of Hedestad. Birger was trying out a new hunting dog, a Swedish foxhound which he had just acquired. Harold Wanger was 73 at the time, and she had done her very best to accept his lunacy, which had made her childhood a nightmare and affected her entire adult life. Cecilia had never before been as fragile as she was then. Her marriage had ended 3 months earlier. Domestic violence. The term was so banal. For her it had taken the form of unceasing abuse, blows to the head, violent shoving, moody threats, and being knocked to the kitchen floor. Her husband's outbursts were inexplicable, and the attacks were not often so severe that she was actually injured. She had become used to it. Until the day when she struck back, and he completely lost control. It ended with him flinging some scissors at her, which lodged in her shoulder blade. He had been remorseful and panicky and drove her to the hospital, making up a story about a bizarre accident which all the staff in the emergency room saw through at once. She had felt ashamed. They gave her 12 stitches and kept her in the hospital for 2 days. Then her uncle picked her up and drove her to his house. She never spoke to her husband again. On that sunny autumn day, Harold Wanger had been in a good mood, almost friendly. But without warning, a long way into the woods, he began to berate her with humiliating invective and revolting remarks about her morals and sexual predilections. He snarled that no wonder such a whore could never keep a man. Her brother apparently did not notice that every word from their father struck her like a whiplash. Instead, Birger suddenly laughed and put his arm around his father, and in his own way made light of the situation by making some comment to the effect that, "You know full well what women are like." He gave Cecilia a cheerful wink and suggested that Harold Wanger take up a position on a little ridge. For a second, a frozen instant, Cecilia Wanger looked at her father and brother and realized that she was holding a loaded shotgun in her hand. She closed her eyes. Her only option at that moment seemed to be to raise the gun and fire both barrels. She wanted to kill them both. Instead, she laid down the weapon at her feet, turned on her heel, and went back to where they had parked the car. She left them high and dry, driving home alone. Since that day, she refused to let her father into her house, and had never been in his.
"You ruined my life," Cecilia Wanger thought. "You ruined my life when I was just a child."
At 8:30, she called Blomqvist. Bjurman was in pain. His muscles were no use to him. His body seemed to be paralyzed. He could not remember if he had lost consciousness, but he was disoriented. When he slowly regained control over his body, he discovered that he was lying naked on his bed, his wrists in handcuffs and his legs spread painfully apart. He had stinging burn marks where electrodes had touched his body. Salander had pulled the cane chair over and was patiently waiting, her boots resting on the bed as she smoked a cigarette. When Bjurman began to speak to her, he found that his mouth was sealed. He turned his head. She had pulled out all his drawers and dumped them and the contents on the floor.
"I found your toys," Salander said.
She held up a riding whip and poked around in the heap of dildos, harness bits, and rubber masks on the floor.
"What's this one for?"
She held up a huge anal plug.
"No, don't try to speak. I won't hear what you say. Was this what you used on me last week? All you have to do is nod."
She leaned towards him expectantly. Bjurman felt cold terror piercing his chest and lost his composure. He tugged at his handcuffs.
She had taken control. Impossible.
He could do nothing to resist when Salander bent over and placed the anal plug between his buttocks.
"So you're a sadist," she said matter-of-factly. "You enjoy shoving things inside people, is that it?"
She looked him in the eyes. Her face was expressionless.
"Without a lubricant, right?"
Bjurman howled into the adhesive tape when Salander roughly spread his cheeks and rammed the plug into its proper place.
"Stop whimpering," Salander said, imitating his voice. "If you complain, I'll have to punish you."
She stood up and went to the other side of the bed. He followed her helplessly with his eyes.
What the hell was this?
Salander had rolled in his 32-inch TV from the living room. She had placed his DVD player on the floor. She looked at him, still holding the whip in her hand.
Do I have your undivided attention? Don't try to talk, just nod. Did you hear what I said?
He nodded.
Good.
She bent down and picked up the rucksack.
Do you recognize this?
He nodded.
It's the rucksack I had when I visited you last week. A practical item. I borrowed it from Milton Security.
She unzipped the bottom pocket.
This is a digital video camera. Do you ever watch Insider on TV3? This is the gear that those nasty reporters use when they have to record something with a hidden camera.
She zipped the pocket back up.
Where's the lens, you're wondering? That's the great thing about it. Wide-angle fiber optics. The lens looks like a button and sits hidden in the buckle on a shoulder strap. Maybe you remember that I put the rucksack here on the table before you started to grope me. I made sure that the lens was directed straight at the bed.
She held up a DVD and slipped it into the player. Then she turned the cane chair so that she could sit and watch the screen. She lit another cigarette and pressed the remote. Advocate Bjorman saw himself open the door for Salander.
Haven't you even learned to tell the time?
She played the whole disc for him. The video ended after 90 minutes in the middle of a scene where a naked Advocate Bjorman sat leaning against the bedstead, drinking a glass of wine as he looked at Salander, curled up with her hands fettered behind her. She turned off the TV and sat in the chair for a good 10 minutes without looking at him. Bjorman did not dare move a muscle. Then she got up and went into the bathroom. When she came back, she sat again in the chair. Her voice was like sandpaper.
"I made a mistake last week," she said. "I thought you were going to make me give you a blowjob again, which is disgusting enough in your case, but not so disgusting that I couldn't do it. I thought I could easily acquire good documentation to prove you're a filthy old prick. I misjudged you. I didn't understand how fucking sick you were." "I'm going to speak plainly," she said. "This video shows you raping a mentally handicapped 24-year-old girl for whom you were appointed guardian. And you have no idea how mentally handicapped I can be if push comes to shove. Anyone who sees this video will discover that you're not merely a pervert, but an insane sadist. This is the second, and I hope the last time I'll ever have to watch this video. It's quite instructive, don't you think? My guess is that you're the one who's going to be institutionalized, not me. Are you following me so far?"
She waited. He did not react, but she could see him quivering. She grabbed the whip and flicked it right over his genitals.
"Are you following me?" she said more loudly.
He nodded.
"Good. So we're singing from the same song sheet."
She pulled the chair up close so she could look into his eyes.
"What do you think we should do about this problem?"
He could not give her an answer.
"Have you any good ideas?"
When he did not react, she reached out and grabbed his scrotum and pulled until his face contorted in pain.
"Have you got any good ideas?" she repeated.
He shook his head.
"Good. I'm going to be pretty fucking mad at you if you ever have any ideas in the future."
She leaned back and stubbed her cigarette out on the carpet.
"This is what's going to happen. Next week, as soon as you manage to shit out that oversized rubber plug in your ass, you're going to inform my bank that I, and I alone, have access to my account. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
Bjorman nodded.
"Good boy. You will never, ever contact me again. In the future, we will meet only if I decide it's necessary. You're under a restraining order to stay away from me."
He nodded repeatedly.
"She doesn't intend to kill me. If you ever try to contact me again, copies of this DVD will wind up in every newsroom in Stockholm. Do you understand?"
He nodded.
"I have to get hold of that video. Once a year, you would turn in your report on my welfare to the guardianship agency. You will report that my life is completely normal, that I have a steady job, that I'm supporting myself, and that you don't think there is anything abnormal about my behaviour. Okay?"
He nodded.
"Each month, you will prepare a report about your non-existent meetings with me. You will describe in detail how positive I am and how well things are going for me. You will post a copy to me. Do you understand?"
He nodded again. Salander noticed absent-mindedly the beads of sweat forming on his forehead.
"In a year or so, let's say 2, you will initiate negotiations in the district court to have my declaration of incompetence rescinded. You will use your faked reports from our meetings as the basis for your proposal. You will find a shrink who will swear under oath that I am completely normal. You're going to have to make an effort. You will do precisely everything in your power to ensure that I am declared competent."
He nodded.
"Do you know why you're going to do your very best? because you have a fucking good reason. If you fail, I'm going to make this video extremely public."
He listened to every syllable Salander was saying. His eyes were burning with hatred. He decided she had made a mistake by letting him live. "You're going to wind up eating this, you fucking cunt. Sooner or later I'm going to crush you." But he continued nodding as vigorously as he could in reply to every question.
"The same applies if you try to contact me."
She mimed a throat-slitting motion.
"Goodbye to this elegant lifestyle and your fine reputation, and your millions in that offshore account."
His eyes widened involuntarily when she mentioned the money.
"How the fucking hell did you know that?"
She smiled and took out another cigarette.
"I want your spare set of keys to this apartment and your office."
He frowned. She leaned forward and smiled sweetly.
"In the future, I'm going to have control over your life.
When you least expect it, when you're in bed asleep, probably, I'm going to appear in the bedroom with this in my hand."
She held up the taser.
"I'll be checking up on you. If I ever find out you have been in bed with a girl again, and it doesn't matter if she's here of her own free will, if I ever find you with any woman at all..."
Salander made the throat-slitting motion again.
"If I should die, if I should fall victim to an accident and be run over by a car or something, then copies of the video will automatically be posted to the newspapers, plus a report in which I describe what it's like to have you as a guardian.
One more thing."
She leaned forward again so that her face was only a couple of inches from his.
"If you ever touch me again, I will kill you. And that's a promise."
Muirman absolutely believed her. There was not a vestige of bluff in her eyes.
"Keep it in mind that I'm crazy, won't you?"
He nodded. She gave him a thoughtful look.
"I don't think you and I are going to be good friends,"
Salander said.
"Right now you're lying there congratulating yourself that I'm dim enough to let you live. You think you have control, even though you're my prisoner, since you think the only thing I can do if I don't kill you is to let you go. So you're full of hope that you can somehow recover your power over me right away. Am I right?"
He shook his head. He was beginning to feel very ill indeed.
"You're going to get a present from me, so you'll always remember our agreement."
She gave him a crooked smile and climbed onto the bed and knelt between his legs. Muirman had no idea what she intended to do, but he felt a sudden terror. Then he saw the needle in her hand. He flopped his head back and forth and tried to twist his body away until she put a knee on his crotch and pressed down in warning.
"Lie rather still, because this is the first time I've used this equipment."
She worked steadily for 2 hours. When she was finished, he had stopped whimpering. He seemed to be almost in a state of apathy. She got down from the bed, cocked her head to one side, and regarded her handiwork with a critical eye. Her artistic talents were limited. The letters looked at best impressionistic. She had used red and blue ink. The message was written in caps, over 5 lines that covered his belly from his nipples to just above his genitals. "I am a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist." She gathered up the needles and placed the ink cartridges in her rucksack. Then she went to the bathroom and washed. She felt a lot better when she came back in the bedroom.
"Good night,"
she said. She unlocked one of the handcuffs and put the key on his stomach before she left. She took her DVD and his bundle of keys with her. It was as they shared a cigarette sometime after midnight that he told her they could not see each other for a while. Cecilia turned her face to him in surprise.
"What do you mean?"
He looked ashamed.
"On Monday I have to go to prison for up to 3 months."
No other explanation was necessary. Cecilia lay in silence for a long time. She felt like crying. Dragan Armansky was suspicious when Salander knocked at his door on Monday afternoon. He had seen no sign of her since he called off the investigation of the Venestrom affair in early January, and every time he tried to reach her she either did not answer or hung up, saying she was busy.
"Have you got a job for me?"
she asked, without any greeting.
"Aye. Great to see you. I thought you died or something."
There were things I had to straighten out.
You often seem to have things to straighten out.
This time it was urgent. I'm back now. Have you got a job for me?
Armansky shook his head.
Sorry, not at the moment.
Sarander looked at him calmly. After a while, he started talking.
Lisbeth, you know I like you, and I like to give you jobs. But you've been gone for 2 months, and I've had tons of jobs. You're simply not reliable. I've had to pay other people to cover for you, and right now I actually don't have a thing.
Could you turn up the volume?
What?
On the radio.
The magazine, Millennium. The news that veteran industrialist Henrik Wanger will be part owner and will have a seat on the board of directors of Millennium comes the same day that the former CEO and publisher Mikael Blomqvist begins serving his 3-month sentence for the libel of businessman Hans-Erik Wennerström. Millennium's editor-in-chief, Erika Berger, announced at a press conference that Blomqvist will resume his role as publisher when his sentence is completed.
Well, isn't that something?
Sarander said so quietly that Armansky only saw her lips move. She stood up and headed for the door.
Wait, where are you going?
Home. I want to check some stuff. Call me when you got something.
The news that Millennium had acquired reinforcements in the form of Henrik Wanger was a considerably bigger event than Lisbeth Sarander had expected. Aftonbladet's evening edition was already out with a story from the TT wire service summing up Wanger's career and stating that it was the first time in almost 20 years that the old industrial magnate had made a public appearance. The news that he was becoming part owner of Millennium was viewed as just as improbable as Peter Wallenberg or Eric Penser popping up as part owners of ETC or sponsors of Ordfront magazine. The story was so big that the 7:30 edition of Rapport ran it as its third lead and gave it a 3-minute slot. Erika Berger was interviewed at a conference table in Millennium's office. All of a sudden, the Wennerström affair was news again.
We made a serious mistake last year, which resulted in the magazine being prosecuted for libel. This is something we regret, and we will be following up this story at a suitable occasion.
What do you mean by following up the story? The reporter said.
I mean that we will eventually be telling our version of events, which we have not done thus far.
You could have done that at the trial.
We chose not to do so. But our investigative journalism will continue as before.
Does that mean you're holding to the story that prompted the indictment?
I have nothing more to say on that subject.
You sacked Mikael Blomqvist after the verdict was delivered.
That is inaccurate. Read our press release. He needed a break. He'll be back as CEO and publisher later this year.
The camera panned through the newsroom while the reporter quickly recounted background information on Millennium's stormy history as an original and outspoken magazine. Blomqvist was not available for comment. He had just been shut up in Ruloka prison about an hour from Östersund in Jämtland. Sarander noticed Dirk Froder at the edge of the TV screen, passing a doorway in the editorial offices. She frowned and bit her lower lip in thought. That Monday had been a slow news day, and Wanger got a whole 4 minutes on the 9 o'clock news. He was interviewed in a TV studio in Hedestad. The reporter began by stating that after 2 decades of having stood back from the spotlight, the industrialist Henrik Wanger was back. The segment began with a snappy biography in black-and-white TV images, showing him with Prime Minister Erlander and opening factories in the 60s. The camera then focused on a studio sofa where Wanger was sitting perfectly relaxed. He wore a yellow shirt, narrow green tie, and comfortable dark brown suit. He was gaunt, but he spoke in a clear, firm voice. And he was also quite candid. The reporter asked Wanger what had prompted him to become a part owner of Millennium.
"It's an excellent magazine, which I have followed with great interest for several years. Today, the publication is under attack. It has enemies who are organizing an advertising boycott, trying to run it into the ground."
The reporter was not prepared for this, but guessed at once that the already unusual story had yet more unexpected aspects.
"What's behind this boycott?"
"That's one of the things that Millennium will be examining closely. But I'll make it clear now that Millennium will not be sunk with the first salvo."
"Is this why you bought into the magazine?"
"It would be deplorable if the special interests had the power to silence those voices in the media that they find uncomfortable."
Wanger acted as though he had been a cultural radical, espousing freedom of speech all his life. Blomqvist burst out laughing as he spent his first evening in the TV room at Ruloka prison. His fellow inmates glanced at him uneasily. Later that evening, when he was lying on the bunk in his cell, which reminded him of a cramped motel room with its tiny table, its one chair and one shelf on the wall, he admitted that Wanger and Berger had been right about how the news would be marketed. He just knew that something had changed in people's attitude towards Millennium. Wanger's support was no more or less than a declaration of war against Venestrom. The message was clear. In the future, you will not be fighting with a magazine with a staff of six and an annual budget corresponding to the cost of a luncheon meeting at the Venestrom Group. You will now be up against the Wanger Corporation, which may be a shadow of its former greatness, but still presents a considerably tougher challenge. The message that Wanger had delivered on TV was that he was prepared to fight, and for Venestrom, that war would be costly. Berger had chosen her words with care. She had not said much, but her saying that the magazine had not told its version created the impression that there was something to tell. Despite the fact that Blomqvist had been indicted, convicted, and was now imprisoned, she had come out and said, if not in so many words, that he was innocent of libel and that another truth existed. Precisely because she had not used the word innocent, his innocence seemed more apparent than ever. The fact that he was going to be reinstated as publisher emphasized that Millennium felt it had nothing to be ashamed of. In the eyes of the public, credibility was no problem. Everyone loves a conspiracy theory, and in the choice between a filthy rich businessman and an outspoken and charming editor-in-chief, it was not hard to guess where the public's sympathies would lie. The media, however, were not going to buy the story so easily. But Berger may have disarmed a number of critics. None of the day's events had changed the situation fundamentally, but they had bought time, and they had shifted the balance of power a little. Blomqvist imagined that Venestrom had probably had an unpleasant evening. Venestrom could not know how much or how little they knew, and before he made his next move, he was going to have to find out. With a grim expression, Berger turned off the TV and the VCR after having watched first her own and then Wanger's interview. It was 2:45 in the morning, and she had to stifle the impulse to call Blomqvist. He was locked up, and it was unlikely that he was allowed to keep his mobile. She had arrived home so late that her husband was already asleep. She went over to the bar and poured herself a healthy measure of Abelour single malt. She drank alcohol about once a year, and sat at the window looking out across Saltsjön to the lighthouse at the entrance to Skuru Sound. She and Blomqvist had argued heatedly when they were alone after she concluded the agreement with Wanger. They had weathered many full-blooded arguments about what angle to use for a specific article, the design of the magazine, the evaluation of their sources' credibility, and a thousand other things involved in putting out a magazine, but the argument in Wanger's guest house had touched on principles that made her aware she was on shaky ground.
"I don't know what to do now," Blomqvist had said. "This man has hired me to ghostwrite his autobiography. Up until now I've been free to get up and leave the moment he tries to force me to write something that isn't true, or tries to persuade me to slant the story in a way I don't hold with. Now he's a part owner of our magazine, and the only one with the resources to save Millennium. All of a sudden I'm sitting on the fence, in a position that a board of professional ethics would never approve."
"Have you got a better idea?" Berger asked him. "Because if you have, spit it out before we type up the contract and sign it."
"Ricky, Wanger is exploiting us in some sort of private vendetta against Venestrom."
"So what? We have a vendetta against Venestrom ourselves."
Blomqvist turned away from her and lit a cigarette. Their conversation had gone on for quite a while until Berger went into the bedroom, undressed, and climbed into bed. She pretended to be asleep when he got in beside her 2 hours later. This evening a reporter from Dagens Nyheter had asked her the same question. "How is Millennium going to be able credibly to assert its independence?"
"What do you mean?"
The reporter thought the question had been clear enough, but he spelled it out anyway.
"One of Millennium's objectives is to investigate corporations. How will the magazine be able to claim, in a credible way, that it's investigating the Wanger Corporation?"
Berger gave him a surprised look, as if the question were completely unexpected.
"Are you insinuating that Millennium's credibility is diminished because a well-known financier with significant resources has entered the picture?"
You could not now credibly investigate the Vanger Corporation.
Is that a rule that applies specifically to Millennium?
Excuse me?
I mean, you work for a publication that is for the most part owned by major corporate entities. Does that mean that none of the newspapers published by the Bonnier Group is credible? Aftenbladet is owned by a huge Norwegian corporation, which in turn is a major player in IT and communications. Does that mean that anything Aftenbladet publishes about the electronics industry is not credible? Metro is owned by the Stenbeck Group. Are you saying that no publication in Sweden that has significant economic interests behind it is credible?
No, of course not.
Then why are you insinuating that Millennium's credibility would be diminished because we also have backers?
The reporter held up his hand.
Okay, I'll retract that question.
No, don't do that. I want you to print exactly what I said. And you can add that if DN promises to focus a little extra on the Vanger Corporation, then we'll focus a little more on the Bonnier Group.
But it was an ethical dilemma. Blomqvist was working for Henrik Vanger, who was in a position to sink Millennium with the stroke of a pen. What would happen if Blomqvist and Vanger became enemies? And above all, what price did she put on her own credibility? And when had she been transformed from an independent editor into a corrupted one? Salander closed her browser and shut down her PowerBook. She was out of work and hungry. The first condition did not worry her so much, since she had regained control over her bank account, and Bjørman had already taken on the status of a vague unpleasantness in her past. The hunger she dealt with by switching on the coffee maker. She made 3 big open rye-bread sandwiches with cheese, caviar, and a hard-boiled egg. She ate her nighttime snacks on the sofa in the living room while she worked on the information she had gathered. The lawyer Frode from Hedestad had hired her to do an investigation of Mikael Blomqvist, the journalist who was given a prison sentence for libeling financier Hans-Erik Wennerström. A few months later, Henrik Vanger, also from Hedestad, joins Blomqvist's magazine's board of directors and claims that there is a conspiracy to crush the magazine. All this on the same day that the former goes to prison. Most fascinating of all, a 2-year-old background article with 2 empty hands about Hans-Erik Wennerström, which he found in the online edition of Monopoly Financial magazine. It seemed that he began his career in the very same Vanger Corporation in the late 60s. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to see that these events were somehow related. There had to be a skeleton in one of their cupboards, and Salander loved hunting skeletons. Besides, she had nothing else on at the moment.
Part 3. Mergers. May 16th to July 11th.
13% of the women in Sweden have been subjected to aggravated sexual assault outside of a sexual relationship. Chapter 15. Friday, May 16th to Saturday, May 31st. Mikael Blomqvist was released from Vuloka prison on Friday, May 16th, 2 months after he was admitted. The same day he entered the facility, he had submitted an application for parole with no great optimism. He never did quite understand the technical reasons behind his release, but it may have had something to do with the fact that he did not use any holiday leave, and that the prison population was 42, while the number of beds was 31. In any case, the warden, Peter Sarowski, a 40-year-old Polish exile, with whom Blomqvist got along well, wrote a recommendation that his sentence be reduced. His time at Roloka had been unstressful and pleasant enough. The prison had been designed, as Sarovsky expressed it, for hooligans and drunk drivers, not for hardened criminals. The daily routines reminded him of living in a youth hostel. His fellow prisoners, half of whom were second-generation immigrants, regarded Blomqvist as something of a rare bird in the group. He was the only inmate to appear on the TV news, which lent him a certain status. On his first day he was called in for a talk and offered therapy, training from Komvux, or the opportunity for other adult education and occupational counselling. He did not feel any need at all for social rehabilitation. He had completed his studies, he thought, and he already had a job. On the other hand, he asked for permission to keep his iBook in his cell, so that he could continue to work on the book he was commissioned to write. His request was granted without further ado, and Sarovsky arranged to bring him a lockable cabinet, so that he could leave the computer in his cell. Not that any of the inmates would have stolen or vandalized it or anything like that. They rather kept a protective eye on him. In this way, Blomqvist spent 2 months working about 6 hours a day on the Wanger Family Chronicle, work that was interrupted only by a few hours of cleaning or recreation each day. Blomqvist and two others, one of whom came from Skövde and had his roots in Chile, were assigned to clean the prison gym each day. Recreation consisted of watching TV, playing cards, or weight training. Blomqvist discovered that he was a passable poker player, but he still lost a few 50-ora coins every day. Regulations permitted playing for money if the total pot did not exceed 5 kronor. He was told of his release only one day before. Sarovsky summoned him to his office, and they shared a toast with Aquavit. Blomqvist went straight back to the cabin in Hedeby. When he walked up the front steps, he heard a meow and found himself escorted by the reddish-brown cat. "Okay, you can come in," he said, "but I have no milk yet." He unpacked his bags. It was as if he had been on holiday, and he realized that he actually missed the company of Sarovsky and his fellow prisoners. Absurd as it seemed, he had enjoyed his time at the Roloka, but his release had come so unexpectedly that he had had no time to let anyone know. It was just after 6 in the evening. He hurried over to Konsum to buy groceries before they closed. When he got home, he called Berger. A message said she was unavailable. He asked for her to call him the next day. Then he walked up to his employer's house. He found Wanger on the ground floor. The old man raised his eyebrows in surprise when he saw Mikhail.
"Did you escape?"
"Released early."
"That's a surprise."
"For me, too. I found out last night." They looked at each other for a few seconds. Then the old man surprised Blomqvist by throwing his arms around him and giving him a bear hug.
"I was just about to eat. Join me."
Anna produced a great quantity of bacon pancakes with lingonberries. They sat there in the dining room and talked for almost 2 hours. Blomqvist told him about how far he had got with the Family Chronicle, and where there were holes and gaps. They did not talk at all about Harriet, but Wanger told him all about Millennium.
"We had a board meeting. Fröken Berger and your partner, Malm, were kind enough to move two of the meetings up here, while Dirk stood in for me at a meeting in Stockholm. I really wish I were a few years younger, but the truth is that it's too tiring for me to travel so far. I'll try to get down there during the summer."
"No reason not to hold the meetings up here," Blomqvist said. "So how does it feel to be a part owner of the magazine?" Wanger gave him a wry smile.
"It's actually the most fun I've had in years. I've taken a look at the finances, and they look pretty fair. I won't have to put up as much money as I thought. The gap between income and expenses is dwindling."
"I talked with Erica this week. She says that advertising revenue has perked up."
"It's starting to turn around, yes, but it'll take time. At first, the companies in the Wanger Corporation went in and bought up a bunch of full-page ads. But 2 former advertisers, Mobile Telephones and a travel bureau, have come back."
He smiled broadly.
"We're also doing a little more one-to-one hustling among Wennerström's enemies. And, believe me, there's a long list."
"Have you heard directly from Wennerström?"
"Well, not really. But we leaked a story that Wennerström is organizing the boycott of Millennium. That must have made him look petty. A reporter at DN is said to have reached him and got a surly reply."
"You are enjoying this, aren't you?"
"Enjoy isn't the word. I should have devoted myself to this years ago."
"What is it between you and Wennerström, anyway?"
"Don't even try. You'll find out at the end of your year."
When Blomqvist left Wanger around 9, there was a distinct feeling of spring in the air. It was dark outside, and he hesitated for a moment. Then he made his familiar circuit and knocked on the door of Cecilia Wanger's house. He wasn't sure what he expected. Cecilia opened her eyes wide and instantly looked uncomfortable as she let him into the hall. They stood there, suddenly unsure of each other. She too asked if he had escaped, and he explained the situation. "I just wanted to say hello. Am I interrupting something?" She avoided his eyes. Mikhail could sense at once that she wasn't particularly glad to see him.
"No. No, come in. Would you like some coffee?"
"I would." He followed her into the kitchen. She stood with her back to him as she filled the coffee maker with water. He put a hand on her shoulder, and she stiffened.
Cecilia. You don't look as if you want to give me coffee.
I wasn't expecting you for another month, she said. You surprised me.
He turned her around so that he could see her face. They stood in silence for a moment. She still would not look him in the eye. Cecilia, forget about the coffee. What's going on? She shook her head and took a deep breath.
Mikhail, I'd like you to leave. Don't ask. Just leave.
Mikhail first walked back to the cottage, but paused at the gate, undecided. Instead of going in, he went down to the water by the bridge and sat on a rock. He smoked a cigarette while he sorted out his thoughts and wondered what could have so dramatically changed Cecilia Wanger's attitude towards him. He suddenly heard the sound of an engine and saw a big white boat slip into the sound beneath the bridge. When it passed, Mikhail saw that it was Martin Wanger standing at the wheel, with his gaze focused on avoiding sunken rocks in the water. The boat was a 40-foot motor cruiser, an impressive bundle of power. He stood up and took the beach path. He discovered that several boats were already in the water at various docks, a mixture of motorboats and sailing boats. There were several Pettersson boats, and at one dock an IF-class yacht was rocking in the wake. Other boats were larger and more expensive vessels. He noticed a Halberg Rassi. The boats also indicated the class distribution of Hedeby's marina. Martin Wanger had, without a doubt, the largest and the plushest boat in view. He stopped below Cecilia Wanger's house and stole a glance at the lighted windows on the top floor. Then he went home and put on some coffee of his own. He went into his office while he waited for it to brew. Before he presented himself at the prison, he had returned the majority of Wanger's documentation on Harriet. It had seemed wise not to leave it in an empty house. Now the shelves looked bare. He had, of the reports, only five of Wanger's own notebooks, and these he had taken with him to Ruloka and now knew by heart. He noticed an album on the top shelf of the bookcase that he had forgotten. He carried it to the kitchen table. He poured himself coffee and began going through it. They were photographs that had been taken on the day Harriet disappeared. The first of them was the last photograph of Harriet at the Children's Day parade in Hederstad. Then there were some 180 crystal-clear pictures of the scene of the accident on the bridge. He had examined the images one by one with a magnifying glass on several occasions previously. Now he turned the pages almost absent-mindedly. He knew he was not going to find anything he had not seen before. In fact, he felt all of a sudden fed up with the unexplainable disappearance of Harriet Wanger and slammed the album shut. Restlessly, he went to the kitchen window and peered out into the darkness. Then he turned his gaze back to the album. He could not have explained the feeling, but a thought flitted through his head, as though he were reacting to something he had just seen. It was as though an invisible creature had whispered in his ear, making the hairs on the back of his neck stand on end. He opened the album again. He went through it, page by page, looking at all the pictures of the bridge. He looked at the younger version of an oil-soaked Henrik Wanger, and a younger Harold, a man whom he had still not met. The broken railing, the buildings, the windows and the vehicles, visible in the pictures. He could not fail to identify a 20-year-old Cecilia in the midst of the onlookers. She had on a light-coloured dress and a dark jacket, and was in at least 20 of the photographs. He felt a fresh excitement, and over the years Blomqvist had learned to trust his instincts. These instincts were reacting to something in the album, but he could not yet say what it was. He was still at the kitchen table at 11, staring one by one again at the photographs when he heard the door open.
"May I come in?"
It was Cecilia Wanger. Without waiting for an answer, she sat down across from him at the table. Blomqvist had a strange feeling of déjà vu. She was dressed in a thin, loose, light-coloured dress, and a greyish-blue jacket, clothes almost identical to those she was wearing in the photographs from 1966.
"You're the one who's the problem," she said.
Blomqvist raised his eyebrows.
"Forgive me, but you took me by surprise when you knocked on the door tonight. Now I'm so unhappy I can't sleep."
"Why are you unhappy?"
"Don't you know?"
He shook his head.
"If I tell you, promise you won't laugh."
"Promise."
When I seduced you last winter, it was an idiotic, impulsive act. I wanted to enjoy myself, that's all. That first night I was quite drunk, and I had no intention of starting anything long-term with you. Then it turned into something else. I want you to know that those weeks with you as my occasional lover were some of the happiest in my life.
I thought it was lovely, too.
Mikhail, I've been lying to you and to myself the whole time. I've never been particularly relaxed about sex. I've had 5 sex partners in my entire life. Once when I was 21 and a debutante. Then with my husband, whom I met when I was 25 and who turned out to be a bastard. And then a few times with 3 guys I met several years apart. But you provoked something in me. I simply couldn't get enough. It had something to do with the fact that you're so undemanding.
Cecilia, you don't have to...
Shh! Don't interrupt, or I'll never be able to tell you this.
Blomqvist sat in silence.
The day you left for prison, I was absolutely miserable. You were gone, as though you had never existed. It was dark here in the guest house. It was cold and empty in my bed. And there I was, an old maid of 56 again.
She said nothing for a while and looked Blomqvist in the eyes.
I fell in love with you last winter. I didn't mean to, but it happened. And then I took stock and realized that you were only here temporarily. One day, you'd be gone for good. And I'll stay here for the rest of my life. It hurt so damn much that I decided I wasn't going to let you in again when you came back from prison.
I'm sorry.
It's not your fault. When you left tonight, I sat and cried. I wish I had the chance to live my life over again. Then I would decide on one thing.
What's that?
She looked down at the table.
That I would have to be totally insane to stop seeing you just because you're going to leave one day. Mikhail, can we start again? Can you forget what happened earlier this evening?
It's forgotten, he said.
But thank you for telling me. She was still looking down at the table.
If you still want me, let's do it.
She looked at him again. Then she got up and went over to the bedroom door. She dropped her jacket on the floor and pulled her dress over her head as she went. Blomqvist and Cecilia Wanger woke up when the front door opened and someone was walking through the kitchen. They heard the thud of something heavy being put down near the wood stove. Then Berger was standing in the bedroom doorway with a smile that rapidly changed to shock.
Oh, good Lord!
She took a step back.
Hi, Erica, Blomqvist said.
Hi. I'm so sorry. I apologize 1,000 times for barging in like this. I should have knocked.
We should have locked the front door. Erica, this is Cecilia Wanger. Cecilia, Erica Berger is the editor-in-chief of Millennium.
Hi,
Cecilia said.
Hi,
Berger said. She looked as though she could not decide whether to step forward and politely shake hands or just leave.
I can go for a walk.
What do you say to putting on some coffee instead?
Blomqvist looked at the alarm clock on the bedside table. Just past noon. Berger nodded and pulled the bedroom door shut. Blomqvist and Cecilia looked at each other. Cecilia appeared embarrassed. They had made love and talked until 4 in the morning. Then Cecilia said she thought she'd sleep over and that in the future she wouldn't give a tinker's cuss who knew she was sleeping with Mikhail Blomqvist. She had slept with her back to him and with his arm tucked around her breasts.
Listen, it's okay, he said. Erica's married and she isn't my girlfriend. We see each other now and then, but she doesn't care at all if you and I have something. She's probably pretty embarrassed herself right now.
When they went into the kitchen a while later, Erica had set out coffee, juice, lemon marmalade, cheese, and toast. It smelled good. Cecilia went straight up to her and held out her hand.
I was a little abrupt in there. Hi. Dear Cecilia, I'm so sorry for stomping in like an elephant,
said a very embarrassed Erica Berger.
Forget it, for God's sake, and let's have breakfast.
After breakfast, Berger excused herself and left them alone, saying that she had to go and say hello to Wanger. Cecilia cleared the table with her back to Mikhail. He went up and put his arms around her.
What's going to happen now?
Cecilia said.
Nothing. This is the way it is. Erica is my best friend. She and I have been together off and on for 20 years, and will probably be on and off together for another 20. I hope so. But we've never been a couple, and we never get in the way of each other's romances.
Is that what we have? A romance?
I don't know what we have. But apparently we get along.
Where's she going to sleep tonight?
We'll find her a room somewhere. One of Henry's